Haiti for the gold francs that Paris had extorted from the country. He said that amount would now come to $21 billion. The following year, Aristide was overthrown in a coup and flown to the Central African Republic by the Americans. After the coup, the United Nations sent in troops who would remain there for 13 years, leaving a legacy of death via cholera and insecurity. 2021, President Jovenel Moïse is assassinated. 2022, currently Haiti is not being run by an elected president, but a group picked by the international community, who many would say prioritize the needs of Western countries and corporations, not the Haitian people. Currently, Haitians are on the street, and the IMF is trying to force the government to take away gasoline subsidies that would pressure the people even more.
Well, let's get back to our guest, Dr. Pierre now. Dr. Pierre, give me a little short history of the damage you feel that's been done to Haiti by colonialism and the colonialists.
To win this independence, Haiti had to fight against the French, the Spanish, the British, the Americans. It's like they were all helping each other. And so if you ever visit Citadel in Haiti, where, you know, it's built at the top, you can see all the cannons that they had that acquired from the various European forces that were fighting them. And so that tells you that from the very beginning. But the other part is, it is, you know, the French, of course, you know, it's the gold franc that it took, which really impoverished the country, because then in order, and the leader at the time felt that he needed to do that in order to get recognition, right? This was a country that had to fight a scorched earth war against this superpower, and they were enslaved Africans with no weapons, right? And they were able to win. And so by the end of this, there's nothing left, you know, on the ground, and they have to start from scratch. But no one would no other nation would recognize them, right, for a long time. And so this president thought that maybe, you know, if they go ahead and pay France, that they would get the recognition so that you can have trade and so on and so forth. But then in paying that, it just meant that you're impoverishing the country, because, you know, it got so bad, and then they had to get a loan from the U.S. to pay off the French. And so they didn't finish paying that till very recently, right? So you can see what this means in terms of paying a debt for your own freedom, right? The paying the European, paying your former enslavers money because you dare be free. The U.S. is very... the U.S. is very much implicated in this. And I do think the Europeans work together. And so I call it, like, you know, pan-European, like, white supremacy, because they do work together. But the U.S., you know, the first thing with the French is the image of Haiti that emerges out of this period, right? So you have a brutal uprising, but they're representing it in the media, in the Western media in the 1800s, as these savages are killing white landowners, raping white women. And so if you look at the images from the early 1800s, that's what you see of Haiti, that these are like violent savages that can't stay that can't really rule themselves. And that image has really followed us over the years. So even if it was like, you know, if there was a shooting and two people got killed, it becomes huge, as opposed to the mass shootings we have in the U.S. every day, right? It doesn't make the news. And part of that is already baked into the worldview, including other countries outside of Europe, because that's the images that they're fed.
What needs to happen, in your opinion, to turn the situation around in Haiti?
It is complex. And I do talk about this, that people think, oh, Haiti is so difficult, so complex, and we don't know what to do. It's actually not that complex. What Haitians want is the UN to get out of their country. The UN is not, the UN is not a democratic institution. It has five core members that make all the decisions, and the five core members are mostly from the West. You know, they finally opened it up to China and Russia. But the UN is not a democratic institution, and we are under occupation. So the Haitian people want the U.S., the UN to get out. They want the U.S. to remove, take down this puppet prime minister that they put in place, that they don't want, because it's under this puppet prime minister that's allowing all of these things to happen. And I have to say, there's illegal mining going on in Haiti. These puppet governments have basically signed over all of Haiti's mineral resources, and the country's rich with mineral resources. Their oil companies drilling right on the outskirts of the island. And so we have to think about the fact that if Haiti is so poor, why is it that every day there are like 4 flights from Miami, Florida to Haiti filled with white businessmen going to Haiti to make money, right? So there's that. And so what Haitians want is they want this so-called, this prime minister that's implicated, by the way, in the assassination of the president, right? And the U.S. knows that. The U.S. has all the evidence. They want the prime minister to come down. They want the UN to leave Haiti, and they want the space for Haitian. They always say this, Haitian solutions. And, you know, before Jovenel Moïse was the president that was assassinated, before he was assassinated in July, there are a bunch of groups that came together in February 2021. And, you know, it was like a coalition for, you know, coming up with a Haitian solution. And there are several groups. One's called the Montana Group, that basically laid out a plan, a 2-year plan for the transitional government, elections, and so on. Well, the U.S. refused to take heed, and not only did they refuse to take heed, they managed to actually, incorporate some of these individuals, right? Managed to get them so that they could basically follow through. And then try to gain favor with the U.S. And so then that basically just took out all the active radical elements from the group. And basically the group just was destroyed. And so now the U.S. is talking about a Haitian solution, but it has handpicked those who are supposed to come up with a Haitian solution. So what we need is to be left alone. These people need to leave us alone. They need to leave the country, leave us alone, and we will figure it out. And we're not even being allowed to do that. They won't leave. You know, they won't leave the country. They won't stop, you know, intervening. And until they do, it's going to be a mess. And I think at this point, Haitians have had it. And I think they're willing to continue protesting. And I have to also say, these current protests have been going on for 6 weeks, but you would never know that, right? Because you would never know that they've been protesting, asking the UN to leave.
Wow, really interesting. Dr. Pierre, do you have any final comments for our viewers?
Well, I just want to say I hope people watching this will take the time and understand the situation is not an exceptional situation in the sense that Haiti is so different from the rest of us, the rest of the world who are suffering from Western imperialism. And so if we understand Haiti and Haitian people as real human beings, not just, you know, these people who won a revolution 200 years ago, real human beings with real needs and need to have access to their own sovereignty and their self-determination. I hope the rest of the world will join us in that fight against the Western imperialism that is really holding, you know, that is keeping us under their boot.
All right. And we hope the same thing. Thanks so much for being with us here on the program, Dr. Pierre. The story of Haiti is one of a country with so much potential, so many resources, but one which has been sabotaged. Many of its members of its upper class have worked in cahoots with Western governments to steal all they can and to create chaos on the island. The real story is the wealth that has been stolen that needs to be returned. This is another story of colonialists and imperialists being held responsible and made to repay what they've stolen, though they can never really repay it. It is estimated that currently France should repay at least $120 billion for the money that it extorted from Haiti. And then the United States should be held responsible for its theft and causing instability in Haiti. There are groups that are taking these demands for reparations to the international community, but will it make a difference? What we know is that the Haitian people are revolutionary and resilient, and we hope that while they are on the streets demanding justice, that this will ultimately lead to their real independence and empowerment. Well, like all of our other files we've mentioned, we will continue to follow up on Haiti, the affluent nation, which has been impoverished and demonized, with the hope that the Haitian people will ultimately get what they deserve. Until next time, I'm Marzia Hashemi. for Hidden Files.
Congratulations to all our Arabi listeners on the occasion of 17th of Rabiul Awal, the birth anniversary of the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today is in fact a day of double celebration. We celebrate the birth anniversary of the sixth infallible successor of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him. Congratulations to all our Muslim listeners on this very auspicious occasion.
In the limelight.
With the increase in the prices of gas, electricity, gasoline, and the intensifying inflationary pressure on the consumers, one out of every six American households is unable to pay their electricity bills. Most Americans do not accept President Joe Biden's explanation for the higher prices of gasoline and fuel, and say he has performed poorly in managing the U.S. economy in general. The U.S. President Joe Biden claims that Russia is responsible for the increase in the price of oil and gas, but a new opinion poll shows that only 1 in 10 Americans, or about 11%, agree with this explanation. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some of the U.S. media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The New York Times reports, gas, electricity, and gasoline prices in the United States are creeping higher, reversing a months-long streak of declines and chipping away at a potent talking point for the Joe Biden administration, which had been emphasizing its success at easing pressure on the American public since this summer. Though the uptick has followed a rise in crude oil prices, analysts point out to two new factors that are also pushing gas and gasoline prices higher: a loss of refining capacity in California and Ohio, and rising demand in recent weeks. According to data from the American Automobile Association, the AAA, the national average price of regular gasoline stood at $3.89 a gallon on Friday, 7th of October, climbing for more than 2 weeks. That's lower than the record of about $5.02 a gallon reached in June of this year, but still higher than usual for this time of the year. Prices have made a particularly big leap in California. At about $6.39 a gallon, prices are close to the state's June record of $6.44 a gallon. Gas prices there and in other western states, including in Nevada and Arizona, jumped after several refineries in the region closed for maintenance. The rise, should it last, could increase pressure on the White House to act quickly to bring down prices. A spike in gas prices, which followed a surge in crude oil and other energy costs after Russia's conflict with Ukraine, became both a political liability and a policy headache as consumer prices rose across the board. President Joe Biden, who over the summer responded to the increase in gas prices by chiding energy companies for profiteering on consumers, released oil from strategic reserves and encouraged Saudi Arabia to produce more oil. Gas prices eventually started to decline. The global oil prices tumbled amid rising concern about the slowing of global economy and demand eased. The recent jump means White House officials have been pressed to address the issue once again. Brian Deese, the director of the National Economic Council, said on Thursday, 6th of October, that energy companies need to lower prices at the petrol pump. Analysts say the refinery shutdowns will be temporary, and the fact that Americans tend to drive less in the winter months could keep prices from climbing as sharply as they did back in June. But a recent rebound in crude oil prices, which rose nearly 17% this week as the world's major oil producers agreed to cut production, means predicting what's next will be difficult. The Hill has covered the same story, but from a different angle. According to a Gallup poll released recently, the American public's view of the economy are declining as gas prices are rising. Two-thirds of the American public surveyed in the poll conducted recently said that gas prices are causing a moderate or severe financial hardship on their household. That figure marks an increase of 15 percentage points from the 52% who said the same back in April, and is among the highest that Gallup has found when posing the question during periods of gas price increases since 2000. Meanwhile, Gallup's Economic Confidence Index, a summary of Americans' ratings of current economic conditions and outlook for the economy's future, dropped 13 percentage points from last month to minus 58. The index ranges from 100, if all respondents describe the economy positively, to minus 100, if all respondents describe the economy negatively. The index's current score is the lowest since February of 2009, when the country was still experiencing the Great Recession. The all-time low was minus 72, recorded back in October of 2008. 8 out of 10 surveyed adults in households earning less than $40,000 a year said gas prices have caused a financial hardship, and 4 out of 10 describe it as severe. Almost 3/4 of respondents from the households earning between $40,000 and $99,999 reported a hardship, and 40% called it severe. Half of respondents from households earning more than $100,000 a year reported a hardship, and 22% called it severe. Aside from the political consequences, a sustained rise in gas prices could affect how businesses and consumers view the US economy. In July, falling gas prices were a key part of the better-than-expected reading of the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, offering a brief glimmer of hope to those looking for signs that inflation has peaked. Russia Today has also covered the same story. According to a Rasmussen poll published recently, just 11% of the American public believe Russian President Vladimir Putin is to blame for record high gas prices in the United States. The majority instead blame President Joe Biden. More than half, or 52% of respondents to the Rasmussen poll conducted recently, pointed to President Biden's poor energy policies as the reason gas prices have become unaffordable, meaning the administration's Putin's price hike narrative does not appear to be catching on. Those who blame neither Joe Biden nor Vladimir Putin point their fingers at oil companies, with 29% of respondents suggesting the industry is leveraging the current geopolitical instability to jack up its prices. Perhaps aware that his Putin's price hike narrative no longer holds water, Joe Biden has been leaning towards blaming oil and gas companies for the ruinous costs of fueling up, recently accusing the industry of making more money than God. President Biden has insisted that oil companies are deliberately holding back from drilling because they make more money not producing more oil. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen recently warned that gas prices may spike again this winter. In an interview with CNN, Janet Yellen said gas prices could rise due to the European Union largely halting Russian oil purchases this winter and banning provision of services that allow Russia to ship oil by tanker. Janet Yellen said it is possible that that could cause a spike in oil prices. The price of gas is widely viewed as a critical issue heading into the midterm elections this November. Some 92% of voters saw the rising price of gas, home heating oil, and other fuels as a serious problem in recent opinion poll, with 68% of the American public calling the problem very serious. With no sign of an economic turnaround and elections coming this November, the Democratic Party is likely to be blamed for voters' economic suffering, and both houses of Congress may end up under Republican control.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The French leaders have seemingly found a solution to the country's energy crisis. Puffer jackets and turtlenecks have become the newest fashion trend in the Élysée, as ministers and the president try to imply a message to the public: wrap up warm for winter. That's while, as the cold season approaches, the nation struggles to afford heating. French motorists have been made to wait in long lines across the country to refuel their vehicles as petrol pumps run dry amid ongoing strikes at the country's oil refineries and storage sites. Almost a third of the petrol stations had problems getting deliveries of fuel as tanker drivers continue their strike over low wages and harsh working conditions amid a cost-of-living crisis in France. So, to cut the long story short, Macron is up to his neck in trouble, and his government's winter wardrobe messaging has drawn accusations of being out of touch with everyday reality. The country's far-right opposition leader, Marine Le Pen, mocked the government saying, "Don't have enough heating? Let them wear cashmere." And Gaspard Ganser, an advisor to former President François Hollande, labeled the idea grotesque and paternalistic. Paris has come up with an energy efficiency plan to get through the winter without blackouts. Homes and offices heated to a maximum of 19 Celsius degrees. No hot water in public buildings, no lit advertising overnight, a ban on doors left open in heated or air-conditioned shops, reduced temperatures in swimming pools and gyms. These are some examples of the action France is taking to save energy. However, environmentalists have accused the French government of promoting tiny measures while failing to take enough action on the climate crisis. They say unenforced and voluntary measures are ineffective. Also, scores of French intellectuals have urged the nation to rise in protest against President Emmanuel Macron's failure to improve economic conditions amid rising inflation. The current situation troubles the French government as a foretaste of problems to come, a potential winter of discontent. Now, the question is, will Macron get his head out of his turtleneck? Thousands of demonstrators gathered in Paris to protest soaring inflation and high cost of living, demanding that France pull out completely from membership in the US-led NATO military alliance. They demanded that President Emmanuel Macron resign, calling on his government to stop supplying arms to Ukraine. Ever since the Ukrainian crisis began, causing a severe energy crisis across Europe, anti-NATO sentiments have been rising among Europeans. Similar protests have been held across the European Union against soaring inflation and the rising cost of living caused by sanctions imposed on Russia in the wake of the Ukraine war. Since the beginning of the war in Ukraine in late February, Western countries have slapped waves of sanctions on Russia. In response, Moscow has either choked up or lessened its gas exports to the rest of Europe, saying it would only resume the gas flow after the economic sanctions were lifted. Disruption in supply chains has led to higher fuel and food prices across the EU, driving inflation to record levels and causing the cost of living to soar. The European Union leaders accused the Kremlin of wielding energy as a weapon, cutting gas supplies in retaliation for sanctions. The protesters also called on the US-led NATO coalition to immediately stop supplying arms to Ukraine and to work to resolve the simmering crisis through diplomacy.
I have three priorities for our economy. Growth, growth, and growth.
Flip-flopping and humiliating U-turn are the terms used by members of parliament and various media outlets on Liz Truss's 180 on her 45% tax cut for the rich. Truss and her chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng thought that a tax cut for the rich would create more jobs and then eventually lead up to tax cuts for the general public as a part of her trickle-down economic plans in what is being referred to in the media as mini-budget.
How is that fair that you get a tax cut of over 2,000 while people on average income see much less?
So everybody is getting a tax cut, and the situation that we were in was we were putting up taxes. That was the immediate situation that we were in. We were facing a situation where the tax burden was at a 70-year high, and that was completely unacceptable. The Prime Minister campaigned for the leadership on the basis that we were going to reduce taxes, and that's exactly what we've done.
Truss and Kwarteng were quickly forced to turn back on their decision as the plan was received very poorly by Truss's own Tory party, who threatened to vote against the tax cuts.
I don't comment on market movements, but what is good for the economy?
Who caused it?
What is good for the economy?
The tax cuts would have been the largest set of unfunded tax cuts for the rich in over 50 years and a huge gamble on public finances and the health of UK economy, according to Welsh Finance Minister Rebecca Evans. When the news broke out about her tax cut plans, the British pound hit a record low against the dollar, prompting a $73 billion budget allocation by Bank of England to shore up the markets before the pound partially recovered. The British Premier, however, blamed communication errors in how the package was presented, and some communication error that was, the kind that shocked markets and voters and couldn't get her the support she needed by her own Conservative Party before she had to back off on it. The controversy in her economic plan comes after the worst start to a new administration in recent memory in the UK, with people already questioning how long Britain's new Prime Minister will remain in office. One might even say trust is fading in Truss. The UK's GDP growth has been on a slow but steady decline since 2014, from 1% down to 0%. It was the pandemic, however, that completely flatlined the UK economy, causing the single biggest slump in its GDP since its GDP was recorded in 1961. By extension, according to the Office for National Statistics, the UK consumer price inflation hit just over 10% in the 12 months to July. That is the highest inflation rate in the country since the early 80s. Things aren't much different outside the UK, across the Green Continent. Certainly the pandemic caused its own set of problems for European economy, but perhaps it was the Ukraine war and the subsequent food and energy crisis that really cemented Europe's ongoing and expected economic downturn. Drastic plans to manage the crisis is being implemented across Europe. 3-hour power cuts to homes and businesses are expected during this winter in the UK. Germany rationed hot water, dimmed streetlights, and shut down swimming pools. French people are using more and more wood and less gas to heat their homes. Buildings in Italy will have 15 extra days without central heating. This all begs the question, is the insistence of the West on prolonging the Ukraine war really worth the damages it is causing their economy and their people?
In the mid-90s, the US was involved in the Cold War with the Soviet Union, but that was a nuclear arms race. Now, however, Washington is fighting another Cold War, with China this time, and in the digital space, a fight for technological superiority. In late August 2022, Washington restricted sales of high-end and sophisticated chips to China and Russia. Top chip designers based in the US have even reported that they have been told to limit sales of their high-end chips. One of the manufacturers, NVIDIA, one of the largest graphical process unit makers in the world, has even revealed through an SEC filing that Washington fears there is a risk that the products may be used militarily in China and Russia. The US says the restrictions are aimed at keeping advanced technologies out of the wrong hands. Meanwhile, China has slammed the restrictions, stating that the US is trying to impose a technological blockade. Beijing added that Washington aims to maintain its technological hegemony through the latest restrictions. The latest round of tensions between China and the US could also present an explanation for Washington's increasing interest in Taiwan. The Biden administration has so far tried to further strengthen its ties with Taiwan, and this has been clearly demonstrated in many cases, the two most notable being top US officials traveling there and Washington offering billions in subsidies to a Taiwanese company if it stops selling its advanced semiconductor chips to China. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, or TSMC, is the largest and most advanced chip manufacturing factory in the world. And Biden's push to stop the sales to Beijing only proves the US's aims that it seeks to impose a technological blockade and maintain or even strengthen its hegemony. The host of measures that Washington is taking to stop Beijing from getting its hands on high-end technology could amount to the biggest shift in US policy on shipping technology to China since the 1990s. The expansion of US powers to control exports of chips made with US tools to China is based on a broadening of the so-called Foreign Direct Product Rule. This is the same principle that gave the US authority to control the export of chips made overseas to Chinese telecoms giant Huawei Technologies, and later to stop the flow of semiconductors to Russia. But the question is whether this will be effective or will it backfire, similar to many other unilateral measures that the US has taken over the past years. Some experts say Washington's move will set the Chinese back, But some, including top American officials in the U.S., say the unilateral controls being put into place will lose effectiveness over time, and the effort could backfire if other countries don't join Washington. The most recent U.S. blockade is aimed at preventing technology from being used by America's military rival. But these chips have a wide range of applications. Even if the blockade ends up being as effective as the U.S. wants it to be, it is only a matter of time before China begins manufacturing its own high-end chipsets, as well as semiconductors, and eventually becoming self-reliant. It started in February 2022, and there seems to be no end in sight. While the Ukrainian military has made some advances, Russia still controls some 20% of the country, and there's nothing that suggests that this war is winding down. The Ukrainian military is backed up by Western weapons and Western intelligence gathering, which tells them where Russian soldiers are and where their bases are located. In the latest in its long list of support for Ukraine, the U.S. Congress has passed another aid for Kiev, which amounts to some $12 billion. And this is on top of nearly $50 billion sent there in the past year. But apart from all the weapons, cash, and intelligence sent and given to Ukraine, reports are emerging that the U.S. has sent men on the ground there. A recent report released by an American news organization, The Intercept, stated that the U.S. Special Operations Forces are on the ground in Ukraine as part of a broad covert operation that includes CIA personnel. According to the report, before the Russian special military operation, the CIA believed Ukraine would fall quickly and so withdrew most of its forces and assets. But later on, as the war lengthened, the CIA began to believe that that wouldn't happen, and Washington sent its covert assets back into Ukraine. But all this back and forth between Russia and Ukraine and the West's unilateral support for Kiev has given rise to a new crisis, one which doesn't only involve the two warring sides anymore, and that is nuclear warfare. On Thursday, at a fundraiser in New York, U.S. President Joe Biden made an extraordinary and, as some say, highly alarming comments about the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war and the threat of a nuclear war. Biden said the risk of nuclear Armageddon is at its highest point since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. But the question which comes to mind is whether this admission is a result of the Biden administration's policy of supporting Ukraine in a war on Russia's border or Moscow's actions so far. Russian President Vladimir Putin has spoken out about using nuclear weapons, but never directly stated that he will use them. During his speech, however, Biden stated that Putin is not joking when he talks about the use of tactical nuclear weapons. The last time the U.S. was faced with such a situation was the Cuban Missile Crisis, which then President John F. Kennedy resolved through negotiations and striking a deal with Cuba. Biden, however, has so far shown no signs of walking back on its policies regarding Ukraine, and this has been clear in the U.S. not showing any interest in diplomacy and virtually cutting off all high-level talks. Not only this, Biden has time and again reiterated his support for Kiev, and the billions of dollars of aid is only a demonstration of the fact. Following the West's unconditional and unilateral support, Kiev has also pushed matters a step further and is now calling for strikes on Russia. Also, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, called for NATO to launch what he called a preventive strike on Russia to prevent Moscow from using nuclear weapons. But this has raised questions about Kiev's ambitions and the chances that the move would spark World War III and possibly a nuclear war. The Kremlin also responded to the comment and said Zelensky was trying to spark a world war. The remark gave birth to internal disputes in Kiev, with Ukrainian officials downplaying what Zelensky said. Now, as the world is faced with several economic, social, and environmental challenges, the warmongering aspirations of the US and its allies seem to have pushed humanity to the point of no return. But many, including Washington and Kiev, seem to be more focused on pushing their own agenda forwards, regardless of what's at stake.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Birthday of the Prophet of Islam. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, the 17th of the Islamic month of Rabiul Awwal is believed by Shia Muslims as the birthday of the Prophet of Islam. Stay tuned for a special feature in this regard. ...507 years after the birth of Prophet Jesus, peace upon him, on 17th of Rabiul Awwal, very queer events took place in the world. All idols fell down and broke into pieces. The palace of the Sassanid Emperor of Iran shook, and 14 turrets of the palace collapsed. The Save Lake, as the place of worship of fire worshippers, dried up. The Fars Fire Temple went out after 1,000 years of burning. A light shone from Hejaz and could be seen everywhere in the world. Devils were scared. The magic of magicians was null and no king was able to speak. On this day, all creatures on earth and in the sky were happy as the best creature, Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was born. God endeared him among people and safeguarded him from every evil and harm. Then, as he reached the age of 40, God bestowed all sciences of both worlds to his heart and gave him the mission to guide the world people towards salvation. According to some of the Sunni sources, the Prophet introduced a few things as the principles of Islam. These things are monotheism, prophethood, daily ritual prayers, zakat, hajj, and fasting of Ramadan. Shia prominent scholar Sheikh Ya'qub Kolaini has narrated from Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, that Islam has been based on five things: daily ritual prayers, zakat, fasting, hajj, and velayat, God-given authority of the Ahlul Bayt, while velayat is superior to other four items. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, also says that testifying the oneness of God, belief in the Prophet's mission, spending of zakat, and accepting the velayat of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt are the principles without which nobody's faith will be accepted. God says in the Quran that unity is the cause of superiority, while discord is the cause of decadence and failure. God says in Ayah 103 of Surah Al-Imran, "And hold fast to Allah's cord and do not be disunited." This ayah also considers brotherhood among Muslims as a divine favor. Hoisting the flag of monotheism has always been the common goal of all Muslims in the Islamic Ummah. All Muslims consider the Prophet as their best guide and leader. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, has thus been the axis of unity for Shias and Sunnis. The Prophet would advise Muslims to obey divine rulers, as it will guarantee unity and will consolidate the pillars of brotherhood among them. Then, the divine mercy will encompass them as the spring rain. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says that leadership in the Islamic Ummah is like the string which gathers all beads of the rosary. Thus, if this string is broken, all beads will be dispersed. The Imam reminds Muslims of the fate of Israelites, saying, "Look how the Israelites were. Once they had gathered together, thoughts and hearts were the same. Hands and swords were helping each other. Visions were deep and decisions were the same. Then, didn't they have great cities round the earth and didn't they rule the world people? So, look at their end. When differences emerged among them, kindness was undermined. Words and hearts were different. They were divided into groups. They killed one another. They became dispersed and fought each other. Thus, God took off their attire of dignity and deprived them of his ample bounty. And what has remained from them is the source of admonition for those who will be admonished." All prophets and divine leaders have reminded us of God's precedence. God says to his prophet in Ayah 43 of Surah Fatir, "So you will never find any change in Allah's precedent, and you will not find any revision in Allah's precedent." The Prophet of Islam says in this regard, "Do not bolt your differences. Those before you did this and were destroyed." He also says, "He who gets away one span from the Muslim community, God will take away the cord of Islam from his neck." Let us gather round the axis of unity, the Messenger of Mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. The commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, saw the greatness of Allah's being, a greatness which the short-sighted vision of you and I cannot see. You are too great to be seen in a tiny mirror. A line from the Persian poet Shahriyar. This tiny mirror of our soul cannot fully reflect that magnificent greatness of Allah. But what about the soul of the commander of the faithful? His soul can. He understands God's greatness. He comprehends. That is why he would spend time alone and weep out of fear of Allah. When Allah is mentioned, that is when the believer's heart is gripped by a state of awe, a feeling of humility, a sensation of fear that stems from their own awareness of their insignificance before Allah's grandeur. Their hearts tremble with awe when Allah is mentioned. That occurs when Allah ceases to be an imaginary thing to them, and when the name of Allah ceases to be something we utter habitually. In a gathering, someone who sits says, "Ya Allah," as an expression of respect to others around him. Someone yawns and says, "La ilaha illallah, there is no God but Allah," out of tiredness. If this is how we mention Allah, it shows our lack of concern for Him, our lack of comprehension of Him, and our utter indifference to His greatness. However, this is not how someone who is aware of Allah's magnificence or comprehends His grandeur behaves.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The faithful are only those whose hearts tremble with awe when Allah is mentioned. This sensation fills their hearts. So this is the first quality of a believer. And when his signs are recited to them, they increase their faith. The second mark of a true believer is that when Allah's signs are recited, whether they recite them to themselves or someone else recites them to them, their faith increases. In other words, this faith is like a seed that has been planted in their hearts, with roots in their souls. Slowly, this seed grows, like a plant reaching upwards, like a great tree with a trunk and branches, with roots so firm that it could never be uprooted. Faith that sits still like stagnant water in the heart of a believer is meaningless. Someone might learn a formula as a child, and as a result of the doubts they feel as they grow up, it cannot penetrate the hardness of their heart. So it shrinks, withers, and fades. A sort of half-faith or half-truth remains in their hearts, but this grows dimmer and dimmer with the passage of time. Such faith can be easily taken from a person. It is a surface faith.
This is IRIB English Radio. IRIB English Radio. With you,
every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The EU's temporary protection directive has been specifically activated to help Ukrainian refugees. It means they are guaranteed housing, healthcare, education and welfare payments in any of the bloc's 27 member states.
I would like today to announce that the temporary protection directive will continue to be in place at least until March 2024.
The European Commission has also launched a scheme to make it easier for millions of Ukrainians in the EU to find jobs. At the same time, thousands of refugees fleeing other conflict zones continue to sleep on the streets throughout the bloc. Also, as the cost of living crisis in the EU intensifies, activists say the bloc's own citizens are not receiving adequate support.
Nowadays we see that people can be homeless and have a job. There's in-work homelessness, but there's also groups that are higher risk of losing their job from one day to the next.
As the war in Ukraine continues, the EU is pondering a ninth round of sanctions against Russia. Moscow's ally Belarus is also very likely to be targeted for cooperating with Russia.
All these steps, especially by the Belarusian regime, are against the will of the majority of the population and will be met with new and strong restrictive measures from the side of the European Union.
There have been renewed calls in the European Parliament for less focus on sanctions, less focus on arming Ukraine, and more focus on peace talks.
We need diplomats to finally take action. This is the view of 77% of all Germans. Political offers need to be made in order to encourage both sides to lay down their weapons.
According to many analysts, Western sanctions against Russia are clearly not working. Otherwise, a ninth package would not be on the agenda. In fact, economists say the current sanctions are hurting EU citizens far more than had been anticipated. Inflation and interest rates continue to rise with no clear end in sight. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A new study covering a huge range of foreign policy issues found that a whopping 79% of Americans believe that the United States should continue to pursue negotiations with Iran. On almost no other key foreign policy question is there such broad support across generations and political affiliations.
Most Americans are heavily fatigued by endless wars and, you know, U.S. Foreign policy adventurism overseas, and, you know, really want political leadership, regardless of which party we're talking about, that is concerned with, you know, more pressing domestic needs.
The study's authors even declared that politicians who criticize diplomatic efforts with Iran are out of step with many of their voters. Joe Biden campaigned on a diplomatic return to the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program. In a major backtracking, not only has he not continued to uphold the United States' end of the deal, but he has imposed round after round of new sanctions on Iran. From the Washington Beltway to Hollywood, Iranophobia, Islamophobia, and violent belligerence towards Tehran has been pushed by America's political, media, and academic elites. However, the poll seems to prove that these messages have been emphatically rejected by the average American.
The level of sway that the defense industry has over Washington, the defense lobby, and the military-industrial complex, that's who the two major parties are beholden to. There's no real significant difference between the Republicans or the Democrats. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned the Iran deal. That's a perfect example.
The poll noted that for the fifth straight year, the percentage of Americans who think the U.S. should negotiate directly with adversaries has grown, now reaching 65%. Two-thirds of America supports the country's total withdrawal from Afghanistan. 40% of people declaring an opinion believe that the U.S. has not responded well to the unrest in Ukraine. The only foreign policy issue which gained as much support